said Pilate. And as if in answer to her recognition, he took a deep breath, rolled his eyes back, and whispered, "Sing, sing," in a hollow voice, before he melted away again. Pilate darted around the cave, calling him, looking for him, while Macon piled the sacks of gold into the tarpaulin. "Let's go, Pilate, let's get out of here." "We can't take that," she pointed a finger at his bundle. "What? Not take it? You lost your mind? That's stealing. We killed a man. They'll be after us all over. If we take his money, then they'll think that's why we did it. We got to leave, Macon. We can't get caught with no bags of money. This ain't money. It's gold. It'll keep us for life, Pilate. We can get another farm. We can leave it, Macon, leave it. Let them find it just where it was." Then she began to shout, "Papa, Papa." Macon slapped her and the little brass box dangled on her ear. She cupped it in her hands for a moment, then leaped on her brother like an antelope. They fought, right there in front of the dead man's staring eyes. Pilate was almost as strong as Macon, but no real match for him, and he probably would have beaten her unconscious had she not got his knife, not yet dry from the old man's blood, and held it ready for his heart. Macon stood very still and watched her eyes. He began calling her ugly names, but she didn't answer. He backed out of the cave and walked a little distance away. All day he waited for her to come out. All day she stayed there. When night came, he just sat at the foot of a tree, unafraid of all the night things that had terrified him before, eyes wide open, waiting for her to stick her woolly head out of the cave. There was no sound from her direction, and he waited the whole night. At dawn, he crept forward a foot at a time, hoping he would catch her asleep. Just then, he heard some dogs and knew hunters were walking nearby. He ran as fast as he could through the woods until he couldn't hear the dogs anymore. Another day and a night he spent trying to work his way back to the cave and avoid the hunters if they were still about. Finally he got there, 3 days and 2 nights later. Inside the cave, the dead man was still looking placidly up at him, but the tarpaulin and the gold were gone. The secretaries went away. So did the children and the dogs. Only the pigeons, the drunks, and the trees were left in the little park. Milkman had eaten almost none of his barbecue. He was watching his father's face, shining with perspiration and the emotions of memory. "She took it, Macon. After all that, she took the gold." "How do you know? You didn't see her take it," said Milkman. "The tarpaulin was green." Macon Dead rubbed his hands together. Pilate came to this city in 1930. 2 years later, they called back all the gold. I figured she'd spent it all in the 20 or so years since I'd seen her, since she was living like poor trash when she got here. It was natural for me to believe she'd got rid of it all. Now you tell me she's got a green sack full of something hard enough to give you a hickey on your head when you bumped into it. That's the gold, boy. That's it. He turned to his son, full face, and licked his lips. "Macon, get it. And you can have half of it. Go wherever you want. Get it. For both of us. Please, get it, son. Get the gold." Chapter 8. Every night now, Guitar was seeing little scraps of Sunday dresses, white and purple, powder blue, pink and white, lace and voile, velvet and silk, cotton and satin, eyelet and grosgrain. The scraps stayed with him all night, and he remembered Magdalene called Lena and Corinthians, bending in the wind to catch the hot red pieces of velvet that had floated under the gaze of Mr. Robert Smith. Only guitar scraps were different. The bits of Sunday dresses that he saw did not fly. They hung in the air quietly, like the whole notes in the last measure of an Easter hymn. Four little colored girls had been blown out of a church, and his mission was to approximate as best he could a similar death of four little white girls some Sunday, since he was the Sunday man. He couldn't do it with a piece of wire or a switchblade. For this, he needed explosives or guns or hand grenades, and that would take money. He knew that the assignments of the days would more and more be the killing of white people in groups, since more and more Negroes were being killed in groups. The single, solitary death was going rapidly out of fashion, and the days might as well prepare themselves for it. So when Milkman came to him with a proposal to steal and share a cachet of gold, Guitar smiled. Gold? He could hardly believe it. Gold. Nobody's got gold, Milkman. Pilot does. It's against the law to have gold. That's why she got it. She can't use it, and she can't report it's being stolen, since she wasn't supposed to have it in the first place. How do we get rid of it? Get greenbacks for it. Leave that to my father. He knows bank people who know other bank people. They'll give him legal tender for it. Legal tender. Guitar laughed softly. How much legal tender will it bring? That's what we have to find out. What's the split? Three ways. Your papa know that? Not yet. He thinks it's two ways. When you gonna tell him? Afterwards. Will he go for it? How can he not go for it? When do we get it? Whenever we want to. Guitar spread his palm. My man. Milkman slapped his hand. Legal tender. Legal tender. I love it. Sounds like a virgin bride. Guitar rubbed the back of his neck and lifted his face to the sun in a gesture of expansiveness and luxury. Now we have to come up with something, a way to get it, said Milkman. Be a breeze, a cool, cool breeze, Guitar continued, smiling at the sun, his eyes closed as though to ready himself for the gold by trying out a little bit of the sun's. A breeze? Now that Guitar was completely enthusiastic, Milkman's own excitement was blunted. Something perverse made him not want to hand the whole score to his friend on a platter. There should be some difficulty, some complication in this adventure. We just walk over there and snatch it off the wall, right? And if Pilot or Reba say anything, we just knock them out of the way. That what you have in mind? He summoned as much irony as he could into his voice. Defeatism, that's what you got. Defeatism. Common sense is what I got. Come on, old dude. Your pappy give you a good thing and you want to fight it. I'm not fighting. I just want to get out alive and breathing so what I snatch does me some good. I don't want to have to give it to a brain surgeon to pull an ice pick out of the back of my head. Can't no ice pick get through the back of your head, nigger? Can get through my heart? What you doing with the heart anyway? Pumping blood, and I like to keep on pumping it. Okay, we got us a problem. A little bitty problem. How can two big men get a 50-pound sack out of a house with three women in it? Women who all together don't weigh 300 pounds. What you have to weigh to pull a trigger? What trigger? Nobody in that house got a gun. You don't know what Hager's got. Look, Milk, she's been trying to kill you for almost a year, used everything she could get her hands on, and never once did she use a gun. So, maybe she's thinking, wait till next month. Next month, she'll be too late, won't she? Guitar leaned his head over to the side and smiled at Milkman, an engaging, boyish smile. Milkman hadn't seen him this relaxed and cordial in a long, long time. He wondered if that's why he had let him in on it. Obviously, he could pull it off alone. But maybe he wanted to see Guitar warm and choking again, his face open and smiling instead of with that grim reaper look. They met again on Sunday on Route 6, away from the colored part of town, a road consisting of used car lots, Dairy Queens, and White Castle hamburger places. It was empty of shoppers that morning, nothing but the occasional sound of automobiles breaking the graveyard silence of the cars in the lots, lined up like tombstones. Since that last conversation, the important one, in which Guitar explained his work, not the brief, chancy talks they'd had afterward, Milkman wished he had had the nerve to ask Guitar the question that was bothering him. Has he? He could hardly phrase the question in his own mind, and certainly could never say it aloud. Guitar had impressed him with the seriousness and the dread of the work of the days and the danger. He had said that the days never even talked about the details among themselves. So Milkman was sure any inquiry from him would only make Guitar sullen again and cold. But the question was there. Has he done it? Has he really killed somebody? Like the old men on 10th Street. Now he bought the morning and evening papers, and once every 2 weeks, the black newspaper, and read nervously, looking for reports of murders that appeared suspicious, pointless. When he found one, he followed the news stories until a suspect was found. Then he had to see if there were any black people murdered by someone other than their own. Did you do it yet? He was like a teenage girl, wondering about the virginity of her friend, the friend who has a look, a manner newly minted, different, separate, focused, somehow. Did you do it yet? Do you know something both exotic and ordinary that I have not felt? Do you now know what it's like to risk your one and only self? How did it feel? Were you afraid? Did it change you? And if I do it, will it change me too? Maybe he could ask him one day, but not this day, when it was so much like old times, taking risks together the way they did when Milkman was 12 and Guitar was a teenager, and they swaggered, haunched, leaned, straddled, ran all over town trying to pick fights or at least scare somebody. Other boys, girls, dogs, pigeons, old women, school principals, drunks, ice cream vendors, and the horses of junkyard men. When they succeeded, they rode the wind and covered their mouths to aggravate their laughter. And when they didn't, when somebody out insulted them or ignored them or sent them running, their wise cracked and name called until the sweat of embarrassment evaporated from the palms of their hands. Now they were men, and the terror they needed to provoke in others, if for no other reason than to feel it themselves, was rarer but not lighter. Dominion won by fear and secured by fear was still sweeter than any that could be got another way. Except for women, whom they liked to win with charm but keep with indifference. It was like that again now, and Milkman didn't want to lose it. There was something else, too. Guitar had placed himself willingly and eagerly in a life cause that would always provide him with a proximity to knife-cold terror. Milkman knew his own needs were milder, for he could thrive in the presence of someone who inspired fear, his father, Pilot, Guitar. He gravitated toward each one, envious of their fearlessness now, even Hager's, in spite of the fact that she was no longer a threat, but a fool who wanted not his death so much as his attention. Guitar could still create the sense of danger, and life lived on the cutting edge. So Milkman had brought him into this scheme only partially for his help, mostly because this escapade cried out for a cutting edge to go with its lark-like quality. With Guitar as his co-conspirator, Milkman could look forward to both fun and fear. They sauntered on down Route 6, stopping frequently to examine the cars, gesticulating, bantering each other about the best way to burglarize a shack that, as Guitar said, didn't have a door or window with a lock. "But it's got people," Milkman insisted. "Three, all crazy. Women, crazy women. Women, you're forgetting, Guitar, how Pilot got the gold in the first place. She waited in a cave with a dead man for 3 days to haul it out. And that was when she was 12. If she did that at 12 to get it, what you think she'll do now, when she's almost 70, to keep it? We don't have to be rough. Cunning is all we need to be." "Okay. Tell me how you're gonna cunning them out of the house." "Well, let's see now." Guitar stopped to scratch his back on a telephone pole. He closed his eyes in either the ecstasy of relief or the rigors of concentration. Milkman stared off into the sky for inspiration, and while glancing toward the rooftops of the used car places, he saw a white peacock poised on the roof of a long, low building that served as headquarters for Nelson Buick. He was about to accept the presence of the bird as one of those waking dreams he was subject to whenever indecisiveness was confronted with reality, when Guitar opened his eyes and said, "God damn, where'd that come from?" Milkman was relieved. "Must have come from the zoo." "That raggedy-ass zoo? Ain't nothing in there but two tired monkeys and some snakes." "Well, where then?" "Beats me. Look, she's flying down." Milkman felt again his unrestrained joy at anything that could fly. "Some jive flying, but look at her strut." "He." "Huh?" "He. That's a he. The male is the only one got that tail full of jewelry. Son of a bitch, look at that." The peacock opened its tail wide. "Let's catch it. Come on, Milk." And Guitar started to run toward the fence. "What for?" asked Milkman, running behind him. "What are we going to do if we catch him?" "Eat him," Guitar shouted. He swung easily over the double pipes that bordered the lot and began to circle the bird at a distance, holding his head a little to the side to fool the peacock, which was strutting around a powder-blue Buick. It closed its tail and let the tips trail in the gravel. The two men stood still, watching. "How come it can't fly no better than a chicken?" Milkman asked. "Too much tail. All that jewelry weighs it down. Like vanity. Can't nobody fly with all that shit. Wanna fly? You gotta give up the shit that weighs you down." The peacock jumped onto the hood of the Buick and once more spread its tail, sending the flashy Buick into oblivion. "Faggot," Guitar laughed softly. "White faggot." Milkman laughed too, and they watched a while more before leaving the used cars and the pure white peacock. But the bird had set them up. Instead of continuing the argument about how they would cop, they began to fantasize about what the gold could buy when it became legal tender. Guitar, eschewing his recent asceticism, allowed himself the pleasure of waking up old dreams. What he would buy for his grandmother and her brother, Uncle Billy, the one who had come up from Florida to help raise them all after his father died. The marker he would buy for his father's grave, pink with lilies carved on it. Then stuff for his brother and sisters and his sister's children. Milkman fantasized too, but not for the stationary things Guitar described. Milkman wanted boats, cars, airplanes, and the command of a large crew. He would be whimsical, generous, mysterious with his money. But all the time he was laughing and going on about what he would do and how he planned to live, he was aware of a falseness in his voice. He wanted the money. Desperately, he believed. But other than making tracks out of the city, far away from not Doctor Street and Sonny's shop and Mary's place and Hager, he could not visualize a life that much different from the one he had. New people, new places, command. That was what he wanted in his life. And he couldn't get deep into Guitar's talk of elegant clothes for himself and his brother, sumptuous meals for Uncle Billy, and week-long card games in which the stakes would be a yard and a half and then a deuce and a quarter. He screamed and shouted "Wee!" at Guitar's list. But because his life was not unpleasant and even had a certain amount of luxury in addition to its comfort, he felt off-center. He just wanted to beat a path away from his parents' past, which was also their present and which was threatening to become his present as well. He hated the acridness in his mother's and father's relationship, the conviction of righteousness they each held on to with both hands, and his efforts to ignore it, transcend it, seemed to work only when he spent his days looking for whatever was lighthearted and without grave consequences. He avoided commitment and strong feelings and shied away from decisions. He wanted to know as little as possible, to feel only enough to get through the day amiably and to be interesting enough to warrant the curiosity of other people, but not their all-consuming devotion. Hager had given him this last and more drama than he could ever want again. He'd always believed his childhood was sterile, but the knowledge Macon and Ruth had given him wrapped his memory of it in septic sheets, heavy with the odor of illness, misery, and unforgiving hearts. His rebellions, minor as they were, had all been in the company of or shared with Guitar. And this latest Jack and the Beanstalk bid for freedom, even though it had been handed to him by his father, assigned almost, stood some chance of success. He had half expected his friend to laugh at him, to refuse with some biting comment that would remind Milkman that Guitar was a mystery man now, a man with blood-deep responsibilities. But when he watched Guitar's face as he described what could be had almost for the asking, he knew right away he hadn't guessed wrong. Maybe the professional assassin had had enough, or had changed his mind. Had he? Did you? As he listened to him go over each detail of meals, clothes, tombstones, he wondered if Guitar simply could not resist the lure of something he never had, money. Guitar smiled at the sun and talked lovingly of televisions and brass beds and week-long card games, but his mind was on the wonders of TNT. By the time they'd exhausted their imaginative spending, it was almost noon, and they were back on the edge of Southside. They picked up where they'd left off in the discussion of the scheme. Guitar was ready now. Milkman was still cautious, too cautious for Guitar. I don't understand you. You come running after me with a dynamite proposition, and for 3 days we talk about it, the best news I've had since pussy, but when we get down to business you come up with some shit about how it can be done. You shucking me or what? What would I be shucking for? I didn't have to tell you about it. I don't know. I don't even know why you're doing it. You know about me. You can guess why I'm in it. But money ain't never been what you needed or couldn't get. Milkman ignored the reference to why Guitar was in it and said as calmly as he could, I needed to get away. I told you, man, I gotta get out of here. Be on my own. On your own? With a $1 million wallet, you call that on your own? Fuck you. What difference does it make why I want it? 'Cause I'm not sure you do want it, at least not bad enough to go ahead and cop. I just want it right. No hassles, no, you know, burglary is a serious crime. I don't want to end up, what burglary? This ain't no burglary. This is pilot. So, they're your people. There's still people, and people scream. What's the worst? What's the worst thing can happen? We bust in, right? Suppose all three of them are there. They're women. What can they do, whip us? Maybe. Come on. Who, Hager? Right up in your face, she blows it. Pilot, she loves you, boy. She wouldn't touch you. You believe that? Yeah, I believe it. Look. You got qualms. Tell me about them. Because you're related. Your daddy's more related than you are. And it's his idea. It's not that. Then what? They're crazy, Guitar. Nobody knows what they'll do. They don't even know. I know they're crazy. Anybody live like they do, selling 50-cent wine and peeing in a bucket with $1 million hanging over their nappy heads has to be. You scared of craziness? If you are, you're crazy. I don't want to be caught, that's all. I don't want to do time. I want to plan it so neither one happens. How come that's too much to ask, to plan? It don't look like planning. Looks like stalling. It is planning. Planning how to get them out the house. How to get us in the house. How to cut that sack off the ceiling and then get back out the house and on down the street. And it's hard to plan with them. They're not regular. They don't have regular habits. And then there's the wineheads. One of them liable to drop in any old time. They're not clock people, Guitar. I don't believe Pilot knows how to tell time, except by the sun. They sleep at night. Anybody sleep can wake up. Anybody woke up can be knocked down. I don't want to knock nobody down. I want them gone when we hit. And what's going to make them leave? Milkman shook his head. An earthquake, maybe. Then let's make an earthquake. How? Set the house on fire. Put a skunk in there, a bear, something, anything. Be serious, man. I'm trying, baby, I'm trying. Don't they go nowhere? All together? All together. Milkman shrugged. Funerals. They go to funerals and circuses. Oh, man, we have to wait for somebody to die or for Ringling Brothers to come to town. I'm trying to figure it out is all. At the moment, we don't have a chance. Well, if a man don't have a chance, then he has to take a chance. Be reasonable. Reasonable? You can't get no pot of gold being reasonable. Can't nobody get no gold being reasonable. You have to be unreasonable. How come you don't know that? Listen to me. I just quit listening. You listen. You got a life? Live it. Live the motherfucking life. Live it. Milkman's eyes opened wide. He tried hard not to swallow, but the clarion call and guitar's voice filled his mouth with salt. The same salt that lay in the bottom of the sea and in the sweat of a horse's neck. A taste so powerful and necessary that stallions galloped miles and days for it. It was new. It was delicious. And it was his own. All the tentativeness, doubt, and inauthenticity that plagued him slithered away without a trace, a sound. Now he knew what his hesitation had been all about. It was not to give an unnatural complexity to a simple job, nor was it to keep guitar on hold. He had simply not believed in it before. When his father told him that long story, it really seemed like Jack and the Beanstalk, some fairy tale mess. He hadn't believed it was really there, or really gold. Or that he could really have it, just for the taking. It was too simple. But guitar believed it, gave it a crisp concreteness, and what's more, made it into an act, an important, real, and daring thing to do. He felt a self inside himself emerge, a clean-lined, definite self. A self that could join the chorus at Railroad Tommy's with more than laughter. He could tell this. The only other real confrontation he'd had was hitting his father. But that wasn't the kind of story that stirred the glitter up in the eyes of the old men in Tommy's. Milkman didn't think through any of this clearly. He only tasted the salt and heard the hunter's horn. In guitar's voice. Tomorrow, he said. Tomorrow night. What time? 1:30. I'll pick you up. Beautiful. Far down the road, a long way from Milkman and guitar, the peacock spread its tail. On autumn nights, in some parts of the city, the wind from the lake brings a sweetish smell to shore, an odor like crystallized ginger or sweet iced tea with a dark clove floating in it. There is no explanation for the smell either, since the lake on September the 19th, 1963, was so full of mill refuse and the chemical wastes of a plastics manufacturer that the hair of the willows that stood near the shore was thin and pale. Carp floated belly up onto the beach, and the doctors at Mercy knew but did not announce that ear infections were a certainty for those who swam in those waters. Yet there was this heavy, spice-sweet smell that made you think of the east and striped tents and the sha-sha-sha of leg bracelets. The people who lived near the lake hadn't noticed the smell for a long time now because when air conditioners came, they shut their windows and slept a light surface sleep under the motor's drone. So the ginger sugar blew unnoticed through the streets, around the trees, over roofs, until, thinned out and weakened a little, it reached Southside. There, where some houses didn't even have screens, let alone air conditioners, the windows were thrown wide open to whatever the night had to offer. And there, the ginger smell was sharp, sharp enough to distort dreams and make the sleeper believe the things he hungered for were right at hand. To the Southside residents who were awake on such nights, it gave all their thoughts and activity a quality of being both intimate and far away. The two men standing near the pines on Darling Street, right near the brown house where wine drinkers went, could smell the air, but they didn't think of ginger. Each thought it was the way freedom smelled, or justice, or luxury, or vengeance. Breathing the air that could have come straight from a marketplace in Accra, they stood for what seemed to them a very long time. One leaned against a tree, his foot hovering off the ground. Finally, one touched the elbow of the other, and they both moved toward an open window. With no trouble at all, they entered. Although they had stood deliberately in the dark of the pine trees, they were unprepared for the deeper darkness that met them there in that room. Neither had seen that kind of blackness, not even behind their own eyelids. More unsettling than the darkness, however, was the fact that in contrast to the heat outside, the slumbering, ginger-laden heat that had people wiping sweat from their neck folds. It was as cold as ice in Pilot's house. Suddenly the moon came out and shone like a flashlight right into the room. They both saw it at the same time. It hung heavy, hung green, like the green of Easter eggs left too long in the dye. And like Easter, it promised everything. The risen sun, and the heart's alone desire. Complete power, total freedom, and perfect justice. Guitar knelt down before it and wove his fingers together into a footstep. Milkman hoisted himself up, one hand on Guitar's head, and shifted himself until he sat on Guitar's shoulders. Slowly, Guitar stood up. Milkman felt upward along the sack until he found its neck. He thought the rope would have to be cut and was annoyed to find the sack hung by wire instead. He hoped the knife would be enough because they hadn't figured on wire and had brought neither pincers nor a wire cutter. The sound of the grating knife filled the room. No one, he thought, could sleep through that. At last, some few strands broke, and it was only a moment before the entire blackness was severed. They'd figured on the weight of the sack being enough to tumble them the minute it was cut free, and planned that at a whispered signal, Guitar would bend his knees and sink down so Milkman's feet would hit the floor almost immediately. But there was no need for this graceful footwork. The bag was much lighter than they had anticipated, and Milkman made it down quite easily. As soon as they both regained balance, there was a huge, airy sigh that each one believed was made by the other. Milkman handed his knife to Guitar, who closed it and tucked it in his back pocket. There was the deep sigh again, and an even more piercing chill. Holding the sack by its neck and its bottom, Milkman followed Guitar to the window. Once Guitar had cleared the sill, he reached back to help Milkman over. The moonlight was playing tricks on him, for he thought he saw the figure of a man standing right behind his friend. Enveloped by the heat, they'd left a few minutes earlier, they walked swiftly away from the house and out onto the road. At another window, open on the same side of the house, the one next to the sink where Hagar washed her hair and where Reba put Pintos to soak, a woman's face appeared. What the devil they want that for? She wondered. Then she picked at the windowsill until she had a splinter of wood and put it in her mouth. Chapter 9. Amanuensis. That was the word she chose, and since it was straight out of the 19th century, her mother approved, relishing the blank stares she received when she told her lady guests what position her daughter had acquired with the state poet laureate. She's Michael Mary Graham's amanuensis. The rickety Latin word made the work her daughter did. She, after all, wasn't required to work. Sound intricate, demanding, and totally in keeping with her education. And the women didn't dare ask for further details. They tried to remember its sound, but still couldn't find it in the dictionary. For they were suitably impressed by the name of Michael Mary Graham. It was a lie, of course, even as the simpler word secretary was a lie. But Ruth repeated it with confidence because she believed it was true. She did not know then, and never found out, that Corinthians was Miss Graham's maid. Unfit for any work other than the making of red velvet roses, she had a hard time finding employment befitting her degree. The 3 years she had spent in college, a junior year in France, and being the granddaughter of the eminent Dr. Foster, should have culminated in something more elegant than the two uniforms that hung on Miss Graham's basement door. That all these advantages didn't was still incredible to her. It had been assumed that she and Magdalene Colina would marry well, but hopes for Corinthians were especially high since she'd gone to college. Her education had taught her how to be an enlightened mother and wife, able to contribute to the civilization, or in her case, the civilizing of her community. And if marriage was not achieved, there were alternative roles, teacher, librarian, or, well, something intelligent and public-spirited. When neither of these fates tapped her on the forehead right away, she simply waited. High-toned and high-yellow, she believed what her mother was also convinced of, that she was a prize for a professional man of color. So there were vacations and weekends in other cities, as well as visits and teas in her own, where and when such men appeared. The first of the black doctors to move there in the 40s, when she graduated, had a son 5 years her junior. The second, a dentist, had two infant girls. The third was a very old physician, rumored to be an alcoholic, whose two sons were already raising families. Then there were teachers, two lawyers, a mortician. But on the few occasions when eligible bachelors were among them, Corinthians was not their choice. She was pretty enough, pleasant enough, and her father had the money they could rely on if needed. But she lacked drive. These men wanted wives who could manage, who were not so well accustomed to middle-class life that they had no ambition, no hunger, no hustle in them. They wanted their wives to like the climbing, the acquiring, and the work it took to maintain status once it was achieved. They wanted wives who would sacrifice themselves and appreciate the hard work and sacrifice of their husbands. Corinthians was a little too elegant. Bryn Mawr in 1940, France in 1939, that was a bit much. Fisk, Howard, Talladega, Tougaloo, that was their hunting territory. A woman who spoke French and who had traveled on the Queen Mary might not have the proper attitude toward future patients or clients. And if the man was a teacher, he steered clear of a woman who had a better education than he did. At one point, post office workers were even being considered suitable for Lena and Corinthians. But that was long after they had reached 35. And after Ruth came to terms with the savage fact that her daughters were not going to marry doctors. It was a shock to them all, which they managed to withstand by not accepting a more complete truth, that they probably were not going to marry anybody. Magdalene Colina seemed resigned to her life. But when Corinthians woke up one day to find herself a 42-year-old maker of rose petals, she suffered a severe depression, which lasted until she made up her mind to get out of the house. So her search for work, which was shock number two, was intense. The 21 years that she had been out of college worked against her for a teaching job. She had none of the new courses now required by the Board of Education. She considered going to the state teacher school to take the required courses, even went to the administration building to register. But the sight of those torpedo breasts under fuzzy blue sweaters, the absolute nakedness of those young faces, drove her out of the building and off the campus like a leaf before a hailstorm, which was too bad, because she had no real skills. Bryn Mawr had done what a 4-year dose of liberal education was designed to do, unfit her for 80% of the useful work of the world, first by training her for leisure time, enrichments, and domestic mindlessness, second by a clear implication that she was too good for such work. After graduation, she returned to a work world in which colored girls, regardless of their background, were in demand for one and only one kind of work. And by 1963, Corinthians' main concern was simply that her family not know that she had been doing it for 2 years. She avoided the other maids on the street and those whom she saw regularly on the bus, assumed that she had some higher household position than theirs since she came to work in high-heeled shoes, and only a woman who didn't have to be on her feet all day could stand the pressure of heels on the long ride home. Corinthians was careful. She carried no shopping bag of shoes, aprons, or uniforms. Instead, she had a book, a small gray book, on which Comte de Daudet was printed in gold lettering on its cover. Once she was inside Miss Graham's house, she changed into her uniform, which was a discreet blue anyway, not white, and put on a pair of loafers before she dropped to her knees with the pail of soapy water. Miss Graham was delighted with Corinthian's dress and slightly uppity manners. It gave her house the foreign air she liked to affect, for she was the core, the very heartbeat of the city's literary world. Michael Mary Graham was very considerate of Corinthian's. When she had large dinner parties, a Swedish cook was hired, and the heavy work was done by the old white rummy she shared with the Goodwill Industries. Nor was she impatient with Corinthian's undistinguished everyday cooking, for Michael Mary ate several small, plain meals. It was also a pleasure and a relief to have a maid who read and who seemed to be acquainted with some of the great masters of literature. So nice to give a maid a copy of Walden for Christmas rather than the dreary envelope, and to be able to say so to her friends. In the world Michael Mary Graham inhabited, her mild liberalism, a residue of her bohemian youth, and her posture of sensitive lady poet passed for anarchy. Corinthians was naive, but she was not a complete fool. She never let her mistress know she had ever been to college or Europe, or could recognize one word of French that Miss Graham had not taught her. Entree, for example. Actually, the work Corinthians did was good for her. In that house, she had what she never had in her own, responsibility. She flourished in a way, and exchanged arrogance occasionally for confidence. The humiliation of wearing a uniform, even if it was blue, and deceiving people, was tempered by the genuine lift which came of having her own money rather than receiving an allowance like a child. And she was surprised to discover that the amount of neatly folded bills Michael Mary handed her each Saturday at noon was within $2 of the amount real secretaries took home each week. Other than scrubbing the kitchen tile and keeping a hard shine on the wooden floors, the work was not hard. The poetess lived alone and shaped her time and activities carefully in order to meet the heavy demands of artistic responsibility. Being a poet, she could, of course, do little else. Marriage, children, all had been sacrificed to the great agony, and her home was a tribute to the fastidiousness of her dedication and the generosity of her father's will. Colors, furnishings, and appointments had been selected for their inspirational value, and she was fond of saying, in deprecating some item, "I couldn't write a line with that in the house." That might be a vase, the new toilet bowl the plumbers hauled in, a plant, or even the Christmas wreath St. John's third grade class presented to her in gratitude for the moving reading she'd given at their holiday assembly. Every morning, between 10 and noon, she wrote, and every afternoon, between 3 and 4:15. Evenings were often given over to discussions and meetings with local poets, painters, musicians, and writers of fiction, at which they praised or condemned other artists, scorned the marketplace, and courted it. Of this group, Michael Mary Graham was the queen, for her poetry had been published, first in 1938, in a volume called Seasons of My Soul. There was a second collection in 1941 called Farther Shores. What was more, her poems had appeared in at least 20 small literary magazines, 2 Slicks, 6 college journals, and the Sunday supplements of countless newspapers. She was also the winner between 1938 and 1958 of 9 Poet of the Year awards, culminating finally in the much-coveted State Poet Laureateship. At the ceremony, her most famous poem, Watchword, was performed by the Choral Speech Society of St. John's High School. None of that, however, had mitigated the reluctance of her publishers to bring out her complete collected works, tentatively called The Farthest Shore. But there was no question in her mind that they would come around. When Miss Graham first saw Corinthians, she was not at all impressed with her. First, because the prospective employee came 10 minutes early for the interview, and Michael Mary, who adhered to her schedule to the minute, was forced to answer the door in a print peignoir. Already irritated by this lapse, she was further disenchanted by the woman's delicate frame. Obviously, she could not put up the screens, take down the storm windows, or endure any sustained heavy cleaning. But when she learned the woman's name, Michael Mary was so charmed by the sound of Corinthians dead, she hired her on the spot. As she told her friends later, her poetic sensibility overwhelmed her good judgment. They got on well together, mistress and maid, and by the 6th month of her stay, Michael Mary suggested that she learn how to type. So Corinthians was almost on her way to becoming an amanuensis after all. Shortly after Miss Graham encouraged her to take typing so she might be helpful with some of her mistress's work, a black man sat down next to Corinthians on the bus. She took little notice of him, only that he was ill-dressed and appeared elderly. But soon she became aware that he was staring at her. A quick corner of the eye peek to verify this was met by his radiant smile. Corinthians turned her head and kept it so until he got off. The next day, he was there again. Once more she made her disdain clear. The rest of the week passed without his watchful eyes. But on the following Monday, he was back, looking at her with an expression that stopped just short of a leer. These occasional meetings went on for a month or so. Corinthians thought she should be afraid of him, for something in his manner suggested waiting, a confident, assured waiting. Then one morning, he dropped the white envelope on the seat beside her just before he got off the bus. She let it lie there all the way to her stop, but couldn't resist scooping it up as surreptitiously as possible when she stood to pull the cord. Standing at the stove, waiting for Michael Mary's milk to skimp, she opened the envelope and withdrew a greeting card. Raised letters of the word friendship hung above a blue and yellow bouquet of flowers and were repeated inside above a verse. Friendship is an outstretched hand, a smile of warm devotion. I offer both to you this day with all the heart's emotion. A white hand of no particular sex held another, smaller, blue and yellow bouquet. There was no signature. Corinthians threw it in the brown paper bag, open for the day's garbage. It stayed there all day, but it also stayed on her mind. When evening came, she reached down through the grapefruit rind, the tea leaves, and the salami casing to find it, brush it clean, and transfer it to her purse. She couldn't explain to herself why. The man was a complete nuisance, and his flirtation an insult. But no one, not anyone at all, had made any attempt, any serious attempt, to flirt with her in a long time. At the very least, the card was good for conversation. She wished he had signed it, not because she wanted to know his name, but so it would look more authentic. Otherwise, somebody might think she bought it herself. For 2 weeks afterward, the man was not on the bus. When he did appear, it was hard for Corinthians not to speak or acknowledge his presence. As they neared the place where he usually got off, he leaned over to her and said, "I truly hope you didn't mind." She looked up, gave him a small, smile, and shook her head. He said nothing more. But on subsequent days, they did exchange greetings, and finally,